I'm going to announce some of our upcoming core seminars. Our core 3 seminars, we have 2 coming up. Our first one is March 23rd. This is core 3, 21st century epidemics, autoimmune, Lyme, and stealth infectious disease. And this is with Dr. David Brady and Dr. Todd Lapine. This will be in Hollywood, Florida. And if you're available to get that seminar, you can certainly call us at the 800 number. We can get you connected. If you can't make the Hollywood, Florida dates, we're doing the Core 3 seminar as well in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And, again, this is the Core 3, 21st Century Epidemics, Autoimmune, Lyme, and Stealth Infectious Disease. On April 6th in Nashville, Tennessee, we have Core 2, and this is Functional Endocrinology, a 21st Century Approach to Thyroid and Adrenal Disorders and the Diabetes Epidemic. This is with Rebecca Murray and Dr. Alan Weiss. And, again, that's in Nashville, Tennessee. So if you can attend any of these, it's great. We're pretty excited about these. They've been a big hit for us. So, Dave, I don't know if you want to expand a little bit on the Core 3.
Yeah, we're going into the beginning of our second year, bringing the Core 3 seminar around the country, and it really dovetails perfectly with tonight's call, actually, because it really deals with the staggering autoimmune epidemic and a lot of the pathogenesis behind it and why it's so out of control, including issues of stealth pathogens, whether they're viral, bacterial. We look at the role of parasites and all kinds of other immune triggers and molecular mimicry triggers for the genesis of autoimmune phenomena, but also look at other environmental antigens triggering autoimmunity, including food antigens, of course, and the gut microenvironment, the microbiota, and changes in composition of microbiota and how that relates to autoimmunity. And we not only talk about a lot of the greatest stuff in the research that's coming out that seems to be paid very little attention in conventional day-to-day practice of clinical medicine, certainly not in integrative and functional medicine, though, but we go very deeply into predictive strategies, prevention strategies, and then treatment strategies once someone may have an autoimmune disease. And the other thing that we really delve into is disorders that are basically caused by pathogens. Whether they're autoimmune or not is debatable, but we look at Lyme, we look at co-infection, and a lot of other really challenging stuff in practice today. So Todd Lapine and I do that, and as Andy said, we'll be in South Florida toward the end of March here, I think on the 23rd, you said, and then we'll be in Philadelphia in June, and then in the fall we'll be taking it to a couple of other locations. I also did want to mention that the Integrative Healthcare Symposium, a really large conference that happens in New York City every year, is also coming up the first weekend in March. I will be speaking on autoimmunity and a lot of the things I just mentioned on Saturday morning. I think it's I don't know the exact date. I think it's March 2nd, and that's at the New York Hilton in Midtown Manhattan. So if you're going to be at IHS, please come by Saturday morning and listen to me if you can, and come say hi. And DFH will have a booth there. You can come meet a lot of the people you hear on the phone all the time. And that's about it. Andy, I'll let you finish out your pre-announcements.
Yeah, Dan, I was just going to mention our third annual Glacier Fest Symposium coming up at the end of July and early August. It's actually July 31st through August 3rd, and this is in beautiful, it's going to be actually this year in Whitefish, Montana. So it'll be a little bit, I guess that would be considered, is that north? I'm not certain, but it's
north of Calistoga. Yeah. But it's right at the gates of Glacier National Park, and that's where Whitefish Ski Resort is. And the conference will actually be at a country club right on the mountains and golf course and all that. So it's going to be really, really nice. And we have a great lineup of speakers again. Our keynote speaker is Dr. Mark Houston. He'll be talking about a lot of the really latest and greatest stuff in cardiovascular disease issues in integrative medicine. And we have a great lineup of speakers. We have Lise Altshuler, a very prominent naturopathic physician, going to be speaking on a lot of complementary and integrative oncology issues. We have Liz Lipsky coming in talking about food as medicine. We have Meg Jordan from the West Coast coming in talking a little bit about the role of the new emerging profession of health coaches, and she's going to talk about some interesting group concepts entering integrative medicine known as healing circles. So we're going to have a lot of, you know, real sort of really cool biochemistry, nutritional biochemistry kind of stuff, but we're going to have some other kind of stuff as well with food-based therapies, with some more mind-based therapies. So we're going to have a lot of fun as usual. We're going to go up into the park. We're going to go fly fishing, rafting, hiking. We're going to go see the manufacturing facility if you want, and see how you know, nutraceuticals are really made to the highest quality standards today. It's just a lot of fun in one of the most beautiful areas of the country you can ever visit. So if you can make it, come on out, go to a great conference, and have some good vacation time too.
Okay, great, Dave. I guess you guys are all set.
All righty. Well, welcome, everyone, to Clinical Rounds. And my name is Dr. David Brady. I'm the Chief Medical Officer of Designs for Health, and I welcome you again to the call. Andy Casagrande is joining me, who did some of the pre-announcements. He'll be running the control panel for the call here, and Andy is our wonderful Director of Product Development at Designs for Health. And we have a great returning guest tonight. We have Nick back. I think, Nick, this is at least your third appearance that I know of. Maybe it's more on Clinical Rounds. But Dr. Nicholas Hedberg is a board-certified chiropractic internist by the American Board of Chiropractic Internists. He received his Bachelor of Science in Exercise Science from the University of Florida and his Doctor of Chiropractic from Texas Chiropractic College in Houston. And he practices in Asheville, North Carolina. He's really developed quite a national reputation on his clinical focus, which is Lyme disease, thyroid disorders, and autoimmunity. He's a book author. His wonderful book, which I had the privilege of writing the foreword to, is called The Thyroid Alternative, and it's a comprehensive guide to diagnosing and treating thyroid disorders. Nick lectures all over the place, a lot of integrative medicine conferences. He's published in many journals. He teaches advanced functional medicine courses with Functional Medicine Town, Professional Co-op, and as adjunct faculty with Hawthorne University. Dr. Hedberg has found that many chronic diseases are a result of stealth infections, and that's what we're going to focus on tonight. And basically, he's also formed a website and a community known as the Infection Connection, and I'll have him tell you a little bit more about that later in the call, but you can learn more at infectionconnection.net. Nick's a good friend of mine. I've known him for probably, over 10 years, I would say, and he has the perfect radio DJ voice, as I always say, and you will hear in a minute. And when you hear that voice, I didn't know this at first. I learned this only a few years ago, but it did not surprise me when I found out that he's quite an accomplished opera singer. And Nick, do you want to do a little tune for us to lead off or not?
No singing tonight, Dave.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for being on, Nick. I appreciate it.
Yeah, great to be on again.
Great. Well, let's dive right into the topic, and we're going to talk a lot about thyroid issues and stealth infections, but we're going to look specifically tonight at the connection between Epstein-Barr virus and autoimmune diseases. And I know that Epstein-Barr virus is certainly not the only virus out there implicated as an autoimmune potential trigger, but let's explore EBV first. So just give us an idea how you first started making the connection between EBV and autoimmune disease, and just lay the groundwork for us, if you don't mind.
Right. So the first connection in the literature between EBV and autoimmune disease was actually in 1971, so a little over 40 years ago, when they found that patients with systemic lupus erythematosus had elevated antibody levels to EBV. And, it was actually about 10 years ago you know, David, you were talking about the connection between Yersinia and thyroiditis, and that just kind of got me into looking at this molecular mimicry. And so I just started noticing patterns on blood chemistries in patients with autoimmune diseases like low white blood cell counts, and then the classic elevated lymphocytes and low neutrophils, you know, which is just a classic picture for chronic viral activity. And so I was seeing that a lot in the patients with autoimmune disease. And the other thing that shows up a lot in these patients were chronic low-grade fevers. You know, these fevers of unknown origin, and, you know, a fever is basically an infection until proven otherwise. And then, you know, one of the other major red flags is, of course, cancer. But in these patients that you know, cancer was not suspected, there was something going on there, you know, causing these chronic low-grade fevers. And then just started doing more and more Epstein-Barr virus panels on the autoimmune patients and seeing them coming back positive, reactivation of the Epstein-Barr virus. And then when I started focusing on that, the viral activity, that's when we started seeing excellent results in a lot of these patients.
Let's see, did you happen to hear my interview earlier this year in January sometime with Derek Enlender, by any chance, from Columbia?
I didn't hear that.
Well, many of you on the call may have heard that, and that was actually we talked about myalgic encephalomyelitis, which is basically, you know, sort of fibromyalgia chronic fatigue syndrome of viral origin, and of course, a lot of different viral agents are being studied and have been studied in relation to that, even though you wouldn't consider that necessarily an autoimmune disease classically. I think it kind of is living in the same kind of sphere or camp. And actually, Enlender was first brought to the U.S. by Stanford to study the relationship between Epstein-Barr virus and cancer. So I thought, you know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, these calls kind of dovetail a little bit. And if you want to know more about his work, you can just look up Derek Enlender. You can go on our library and download and listen to that clinical rounds call and some of the research he's doing at Columbia on fibromyalgia chronic fatigue patients related to viral etiology and immune dysfunction from virus. But certainly this is in play in classic autoimmune conditions as well. So tell us just a little bit more about Epstein-Barr virus, you know, some of the characteristics of the virus, the epidemiology of it out there, mechanisms, and can you share anything meaty like that on EBV?
Right, so a lot of people forget that Epstein-Barr virus is a herpes virus. It's in that family. It's a gamma virus, and it's very different from the other herpes virus in that it's the only one to infect B cells, and it's these naive B cells that get infected. And, you know, the other thing to know about it is that unlike, you know, for example, say the flu virus, where, you know, when the flu multiplies and it expands, the cell is destroyed. You know, there's almost instantaneous cell lysis and, you know, viruses are spread into the system. The herpes viruses are very slow. What they do is called budding. And the budding is just basically the virus is using the DNA to replicate itself, but the cell is actually not destroyed. And that's one of the main
differences. So that's why there's not such a virulent course or a fulminant, you know, obvious acute illness like there is with something like the flu, I would imagine.
Exactly. So it's slow like that, and the host cell is spared by the virus. And, you know, the other herpes viruses are, of course, the cytomegalovirus, and then we have herpes 1, 2, 6, 7, and 8, and we're learning a lot more about herpes 6 and autoimmune disease, and then, of course, the varicella zoster chickenpox virus. But about, you know, 95% of the world's population is infected with Epstein-Barr virus, and most people get it before the age of 3, and they're asymptomatic.
What was the percentage you gave, Nick?
95%.
Okay.
Yeah, so, and most people get it by the age of 3, but there's no symptoms. And then there's about 100% infection rates, you know, of those individuals, of course, by the time they reach adolescence, and it's usually because they're stressed, the immune system's compromised, or they get a higher viral load, because EBV, you know, it's the cause of the classic, you know, the kissing disease, mononucleosis, and a lot of people get that, you know, in adolescence, in high school, and into college. So it is transmitted by saliva, and the first place that it infects are the B cells in the tonsils. That's where it germinates, and that's where it really sets up shop.
Well, if so many people, it's almost, you know, just universal that we're infected, what makes one person progress on to autoimmune disease or some other type of chronic illness and, you know, the majority of people not?
Right, and that's what I was going to be I'm talking about tonight, Dr. Pender's hypothesis of Epstein-Barr virus and autoimmunity. And he has this eight-step hypothesis, and Dr. Pender is out of the University of Queensland School of Medicine in Australia, and he breaks it down into eight steps. So I just want to go through these briefly. The step one is a genetic CD8 T-cell deficiency. So basically, these viral-infected B cells are normally metabolized and controlled by cytotoxic CD8 T cells. But if there's a genetic deficiency there, then it allows for an uncontrolled environment of the EBV infection. So you start with the genetic deficiency. The second part is, of course, the primary EBV infection. Step three is a decreased cytotoxic CD8 T cell control of the infection. Step four is an increased EBV load and increased anti-EBV antibodies. And then step five is EBV infection in the target organ. So, for example, these infected B cells with EBV actually would enter, for example, the thyroid gland and germinate in that area and progress and maintain a low-grade infection in the thyroid gland, as an example. Other examples would be, say, the salivary gland in Sjogren's, the gut in Crohn's disease, you know, examples like that. Step six is clonal expansion of the EBV-infected B cells in the target organ. Step seven, infiltration of autoreactive T cells into the target organ. And then finally, step eight, you get these ectopic lymphoid follicles in the target organ. So, for example, when you see a follicle in the thyroid, what they found is that that follicle is actually filled with EBV-infected B cells. So it's a really fascinating hypothesis, and when you put it all together, it makes sense, and it also would explain why, if everyone has it, you know, why doesn't everyone have autoimmune disease?
And can you pick up this genetic lack of those specific CD8 cells with lymphocyte subset testing, or do you have to do genetic testing? Can you just look at the cell population in some way? Can you offer any wisdom there?
Yeah, so, yeah, let's just talk about the testing. And just on a side note, the Epstein-Barr virus panels that are offered, you know, through the major labs like LabCorp and Quest, et cetera, they're looking at the, you know, three main things, which is the nuclear antigen, the viral capsid antigen, and the early antigen. And unfortunately, in their standard panels, they leave out the IgM from the nuclear antigen and the early antigen. So what I started doing is testing IgG and IgM for all three, and so I'm seeing a lot more activity when I do that. But, yeah, you can do a basically just a CD4-CD8 ratio, and what you'll see, and this is one of the things he talks about in his papers, there's one common theme among almost everyone who has autoimmune disease, and that's a low CD8 count. So their CD4-CD8 ratio is elevated. CD4 is high, CD8 is low, which indicates chronic infection and the body is really not able to deal with it. The other
and
thing
what
tells you,
number do Do you know the ratio number off the top of your head that would be considered a starting to get abnormal? Is do you use some functional ranges, or do you rely on the laboratory ranges?
There are functional ranges available, but pretty much anything above 2.0, once you start seeing it get above that, then that's considered you're starting to see some activity. But most of these people, it's going to be very, very obvious. You'll see it up around 4, 6, or 8. You'll see it very high.
I pulled an interesting paper a while back, and I've had it in my slides, my autoimmune presentation slides for a while, and it goes back to January of 2009. It was published in Virology Journal by Rachel Desaloud, I believe is how you say it, and Didier Hober. But it's entitled Viruses and Thyroiditis, an Update. And they talk about the fact that viral infections are frequently cited as major environmental factors involved in subacute thyroiditis and autoimmune thyroid diseases. But basically, you know, there's been a controversy on whether these viral agents are responsible for the thyroid disease and autoimmunity, or whether they're just sort of innocent bystanders or, you know, I guess creatures of opportunity, if you will. But they really break down the classification quite a lot. They show direct evidence of the presence of viruses or their components, in this case, in the organ, in the thyroid. For retroviruses, HSV, mumps in subacute thyroiditis, and retroviruses like HTLV-1, which is the human T lymphotropic virus 1, I believe. That's the virus that's implicated in causing leukemias and lymphomas. I think it's, I think 1 in 20 to 1 in 25 people infected actually go on to develop cancer. But also SV40, and then they break it down interestingly. They say in Graves' disease, they find evidence for this HTLV-1, enterovirus, rubella, mumps, HSV, EBV, and parvovirus in Hashimoto's thyroiditis. So they're almost breaking down different variants of thyroid autoimmunity and implicating, well, not implicating in causality. They're certainly coming up short of that, but they're showing an association between the presence of these viruses in the thyroid tissue and these subvariants of autoimmune disease of the thyroid. Do you have any comment on that? Can you really break it down to which virus in which subvariant? Have you seen that clinically?
Yeah, we did. I actually did discuss that paper in our call in the fall, that Virology 2009 paper in. You know, one of the things they do say in that paper is that you can have, chronic viral activity in an organ with no systemic consequences, and that can make it very difficult to identify if the, you know, virus is in fact driving the autoimmunity. Because if nothing's happening systemically, you know, if there's no fever, if there's nothing happening on the CBC, and if you're not even able to pick it up on, say, the Epstein-Barr virus panel, then, yeah, that can definitely be difficult. But as far as separating, you know, the viruses and identifying exactly which one is there, just in my clinical experience, it's really the Epstein-Barr virus that tends to be the most active, especially with thyroiditis, but in the majority of the autoimmune diseases.
But, you know, we see so much information flying at us now on environmental antigens and their potential to cause, you know, crossover autoimmunity to, you know, specific target host tissues. And certainly thyroids, you know, very high up on that list, showing multiple types of environmental antigens. I mean, you've talked about, you know, the Yersinia connection, Yersinia enterocolitica, overgrowth in the GI microbiota, and its strong association with autoimmune thyroid activity, but also food antigens. You know, we know that celiac patients are 10 to 20 times, depending on what study you look at, more likely to have autoimmune thyroid phenomena. So it seems like there's a lot of different potential triggers that can cause autoimmunity against one target tissue, and that creates an issue because it's not a nice, tidy, neat thing for medicine to, you know, to wrap their hands around. They really love the one, you know, one pathogen, one disease kind of model. Mm-hmm. And the minute they can't prove that every patient with disease X has infection with organism Y, they kind of abandon that, that's even in play. That you know, just they think it breaks down. And there's been some interesting papers that attack that whole way of thinking. And one of them, it was a Japanese researcher, last name begins with M, I can't remember, but basically it was done on MS. And basically what they showed that there were certain types of structural peptides or proteins expressed across a broad spectrum of, they were looking at bacteria in the gut, against a broad spectrum of bacteria, not just one organism, but sort of these same type of structural patterns presented by organisms that are, you know, conserved by organisms across a whole phyla sometimes of bacteria that can cause this autoimmune phenomenon. In this case, it was against myelin basic protein in MS. So they show that the whole concept of trying to implicate one organism, one disease, with this molecular mimicry phenomena, it breaks down because there's more than one, you know, environmental antigen that can get the train rolling, essentially. So I think we, you know, standard orthodox medicine has kind of opened up the blinders a little bit to think more dynamically and less in a reductionist way about the pathogenesis of some of this autoimmune phenomena.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the point about gluten and celiac disease because, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm seeing just a large number of patients with autoimmune diseases who they've already been on a gluten-free diet for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. They haven't had a single nanoparticle of gluten for 5 years. They're taking vitamin D. They've done, you know, leaky gut reparative strategies. They've done everything, and they still have autoimmunity, and they're still sick.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, so they've already done everything that's out there. And then when you take a closer look, in a lot of these cases, you know, we do find chronic, you know, stealth infectious activity, and that's just sort of the tipping point that that gets them feeling better, you know, at least in my experience.
Well, let's talk a little bit about vitamin D since you brought it up because, as you know, it's a very controversial thing in autoimmunity. All the sort of conventional vitamin D experts, you know, throw a lot of the data at you showing that, you know, vitamin D deficiency or suboptimal vitamin D is very, very common. And they, you know, you look at the epidemiology of latitude, if you will, with MS and all of that, and it's kind of very interesting, kind of fits together nicely, and a lot of people with autoimmune disorders of various types certainly do have low 25-hydroxy D3 levels. And there's even a lot of literature showing that when you put them on vitamin D repletion, get their levels up, a lot of them clinically do better. Then you have the other camp, you know, sort of the Marshall camp, if you will, talking about, you know, that maybe the fact that all these people have low vitamin D is simply because they have a stealth pathogen that's infected their immune cells, particularly their monocytes and some other specific cells that overconvert 25 to 125. They basically activate vitamin D in an accelerated fashion. So if you look at the 125, you're going to find where all those D reserves are, and the 25 is low because it's all been converted already. And if you give vitamin D, you're actually driving the pathology harder. And it's definitely an interesting concept, and it's been somewhat rejected by the experts, but, you know, so was Kilmer McCulley, and so was Robin Mead, and, you know, the stories go on and on about that. And Marshall has some interesting ideas about that. Seems like the data is strongest in sarcoid, but not in some of the other autoimmune phenomena. But he really paints a picture for potential a potential pathological model for stealth infection causing these autoimmune disorders by basically activating immune cells and causing overconversion of vitamin D, which destabilizes the immune system in and of itself. So what do you have any thoughts on that whole concept and that controversy?
Yeah, you know, there's two sayings that I love that I sort of live my life by, and also, you know, what I kind of drive my practice under. And the first is by Oscar Wilde, and Oscar says, "Everything popular is wrong." And the second is Mark Twain, and Mark Twain said, "Whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it's time to pause and reflect." And so whenever I see something that's very, very popular and everyone's doing it, like everyone's doing gluten-free, everyone's doing vitamin D, you know, everyone's doing these things, but why aren't they working in so many people? Now, vitamin D, one of the things we know is that CD8 T cells, of all the immune system cells in the body, they have the highest number of vitamin D receptors. And we know that if we expose someone to natural sunlight or we put them in a solarium, that increases their CD8 T cells. So that brings the CD4-CD8 ratio back into balance. And, you know, Dr. Pender talks about how it's inversely proportional. When vitamin D goes down, then you see changes in the cytotoxic CD8 T cells and vice versa. So low vitamin D is, as he says, it's just more of an aggravating factor for autoimmune disease, because you start to see that shift. And when you see the shift, then you lose the ability to control the chronic infection if it's there. I just want to make that very clear that, you know, I'm not saying that everyone with autoimmune disease has it because of Epstein-Barr virus. You know, I don't want to come across like that. What I'm saying is that you really need to be aware of it, and you really need to look for it very, very closely, because it's going to be there and it's going to be active in many of these patients. So you talked about the high latitudes. You know, you see more autoimmune disease. We've known that, like about MS and rheumatoid arthritis, for example. So there's definitely something there. And, you know, I found clinically that, yeah, you know, vitamin D supplementation, it does really help, but it's obviously not the whole picture.
Do you have any specific thoughts about Marshall's ideas that you might actually be doing them harm by, you know, reinforcing the pathology, if you will? And he uses the ACE inhibitors and all these different things to manipulate the vitamin D receptor and pulsed antibiotics to deal with the stealth infection, and, you know, claims a lot of success. You know, I've played around with Marshall Protocol. I have some colleagues that have, but really don't have enough clinical experience directly using it to make any firm conclusions, partially because I'm still up in the air on whether I buy the whole thing or not, because you got equally compelling, if not more, data suggesting the opposite. So it really is confusing for the practitioner.
Yeah, back when, you know, I was really getting into Lyme disease, I read, you know, all of Marshall's material and studied it, and I'm just very open-minded about it for a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, I've seen patients with Lyme who really tried, you know, the antibiotic route for years. They tried the natural route. They tried both. And then they went to a practitioner who'd used the Marshall Protocol, and they got well. But then there's also just as many people who have tried the Marshall Protocol and it didn't work for them, and, you know, antibiotics or herbs and things like that worked. So, I mean, I can't say definitively, you know, if either side is right or wrong. I don't think we really know enough at this point to make a really strong conclusion there.
How about, I mean, we talked about vitamin D, but how about the role of estrogen? I always found that really interesting because, you know, there are some exceptions, but usually you look down the list of autoimmune diseases and the epidemiology, and it's clearly apparent that, you know, the female predominance is striking. No one's really fully or adequately explained it. I've heard various theories, certainly heard some of the theories on estrogen's role, but do you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, you know, there's some brief information on that. Basically, what we know is that the connection between estrogen and the cytotoxic CD8 T cells, they're inversely proportional. So as estrogen levels rise, CD8 T cell levels drop. And then when estrogen levels drop, obviously the CD8 count rises and the CD4-CD8 ratio comes back into balance. So, you know, just part of the theory is that, of course, one of the reasons why women are more prone to autoimmune disease is because of the estrogen, which suppresses cytotoxic T cells. The other thing we, you know, sometimes you see is that when women, you know, go into menopause and their, you know, estrogen levels are dropping, you'll see a lot of changes in their autoimmunity and their autoimmune disease. I mean, there's a lot going on there hormonally, but you will see shifts in the CD4-CD8 ratio as the estrogen level shifts as well.
Well, we talked about different autoimmune diseases and different predilections and different potential triggers and the like, and you know, Epstein-Barr virus is what we're concentrating on tonight, and we did mention thyroid quite a bit, but how about the other autoimmune conditions? What does the literature say tying EBV specifically to various autoimmune diseases? Are there some with stronger sort of associations or connections than others?
Right. So the strongest connections in the literature, and you know, this can be difficult to do when everyone has the virus, so they look at age-matched controls in these studies, and so they're looking at people who are of similar age, you know, who have it and don't have it. And so the what they call the big five autoimmune diseases connected with EBV are Hashimoto's thyroiditis, Graves' disease, multiple sclerosis, systemic lupus erythematosus, and this may surprise people, but actually celiac disease is number five. And there's just some really interesting research on the connection between Epstein-Barr virus and celiac disease. And then the other aspects that they look at are how well is the immune system controlling Epstein-Barr virus infections. And what they found is there are six main autoimmune diseases where they found specifically that the immune system control of the EBV infection was significantly compromised. And those six were lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, Sjogren's, multiple sclerosis, primary biliary cirrhosis, and systemic sclerosis. So, you know, those are some of the most common, you know, autoimmune diseases that we see. And so there's some pretty strong connections there. And then the third aspect that I wanted to talk about was when they go in and they want to look specifically at EBV-infected B cells and target organs, they're able to do that, you know, with various methods like PCR and things like that. And so when they go in and they extract B cells from, say, the thyroid glands of Graves' disease patients, the salivary glands of Sjogren's patients, the colons of patients with Crohn's, the myelin in the brain of MS, and the thymus in myasthenia gravis, they found very, very high levels of Epstein-Barr virus DNA in those tissues. So those are some pretty strong connections there as well. And compared to controls, they don't find that at all. You know, in those tissues in patients who don't have the autoimmune diseases. So that's pretty compelling.
We have a lot of this stuff. We have a lot of association data, and they're starting to connect the dots on what's associated to what statistically. But what is lacking, there are a lot of great hypotheses on mechanisms of actual causality or etiology of these organisms, but have you seen a lot of really good hard data? For instance, like, what's the connection with EBV and celiac? You know, we're always taught, well, it's the, you know, it's the gluten-gliadin antibodies, and this is how they, you know, and this is how the destruction occurs in the GI, you know, tissue and yada yada. I mean, what's EBV doing? Do we know? Or is it just happened to be along for the ride?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the studies with celiac disease and EBV, they're making a connection there between when the patient was infected, if there's actual reactivation, you know, of the Epstein-Barr virus, and then the onset of celiac disease. And then, of course, if they're taking, you know, direct tissue samples from the gut tissue, you know, in celiacs, they'll find, you know, extremely high levels of Epstein-Barr virus in the follicles, in the guts, you know, the patients with celiac disease. So,
well, you can argue, listen, this is a compromised patient with a dysfunctional immune system with a lot of inflammation. They're, you know, this is an opportunistic pathogen that's ubiquitous, pretty much. Boom, it's just flaring up because this person is compromised and it sees its opportunity. It's not causing the problem. It's just feasting on it, if you will, you know, and that's
– Right, right.
You know, it's going to be interesting when we know a little bit more how to answer those questions. Let's say EBV is in play. I mean, interesting. I mean, obviously in integrative medicine, nutritional medicine, there are a lot of different ways we attack viral issues, acute and chronic, depending on the type of virus. With encapsulated viruses, you can use things that try to dissolve the encapsulation on the virus. You can use things that upregulate natural killer cell function, you know, direct immune enhancers, antiseptic stuff. There's a lot of different things you can do. What do you do, and what do you have success with?
Right. So, you know, everything else aside, you know, everything else that we do in functional medicine, you know, once we've done all that or we're doing it, then we want to go and directly target the Epstein-Barr virus. And so the first is we like to use monolaurin, which is a fatty ester that dissolves the fatty acid envelope around the virus, and that basically exposes it to the immune system. It takes away its stealth abilities. Then we just kind of do that in like a pyramid style. You start out very slowly with the monolauric acid, and then you build up to extremely high levels and then taper back down.
What kind of dosing are you talking about, where you start the high level and then, you know?
Yeah, so we'll just start at 600 milligrams three times a day. Each capsule, you know, 600 milligrams, and you'll slowly work up to three capsules three times a day. So you're up to nine capsules a day at the, you know, the top of the pyramid, so to speak, and then working your way back down to, you know, two or three as far as maintenance goes. And that's done over about a 4 to 6 week period. Herbally, there's just a tremendous amount of things that you can use. The first one of my favorites is Laurea tridentata, also known as chaparral. And that was used a lot by the Native Americans for infections. But there's been some really good research on Laurea and its deactivation of the herpes virus. The second one is olive leaf extract, just a classic antiviral, also a good antibacterial. And then one of my favorites is reishi mushroom. The thing about reishi is that it does stimulate the immune system, but it also contains what are called triterpenes. The triterpenes have been shown to directly deactivate the Epstein-Barr virus. So you get kind of a nice tandem there. You get support of the immune system, and you get direct action on the Epstein-Barr virus. Schisandra berry is good, and Morinda, you know, also known as Noni, is another good herb. And then just some other great antivirals are, of course, lysine, the amino acid, zinc, vitamin C, quercetin, and actually, you know, silver. you know, silver silicon, colloidal silicon, you know, just any of the silver products are excellent in some cases for these viruses as well.
What about the other mushroom fractions that are, you know, NK cell, you know, pushers, you know, with, you said reishi, but what about, you know, maitake, shiitake, all of those kind of things?
I've never used any of those, but I'm sure they're very effective. It would be interesting to see if they have, like, the tritropines or any other compounds that directly affect the virus as well.
How about, what about larch? Larch?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I mean, that's a great, you know, compound for the immune system. I haven't used it really in practice, but I'm sure that could work well, too.
And then how about beta-1,3-glucan? Have you used that at all?
I haven't just used it by itself. I know that the mushrooms contain glucans, mm-hmm. and so, you know, they're just kind of being used there indirectly. And that brings up another point. I think a lot of practitioners might be scared to use immune stimulants in autoimmune disease.
Yep, that was the next question.
I just really haven't seen that clinically. I mean, you know, people are very – they get concerned about, you know, the whole Th1, Th2 balance, you know, stimulating one side or the other. But I haven't really seen it, you know, exacerbate people, especially with the reishi mushroom, which is a pretty strong, you know, Th1 stimulant. And in some cases they'd say, well, you know, if the autoimmunity is Th1 driven, then you shouldn't drive it, you know, further. But there's some really good papers out there.
That are really complex substances tend to have a balancing effect, not just heavy-handed one way or the other. And, you know, even that whole classification system of, you know, Th1 dominant, Th2 dominant autoimmunity, if you really look at the research, a lot of that's kind of falling by the wayside a little bit as mm-hmm. we learn more about the complexity
exactly.
of the immune response. You know, not totally, but it is being chipped away at to a large degree.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
How about just before we go into questions, because we're getting late, any kind of interesting cases where you've had success with this approach or anything?
Yeah, yeah. This was a woman in her early 30s who developed Hashimoto's thyroiditis and alopecia areata. And, you know, for those of you who don't know, the alopecia, people start losing, you know, just big patches of hair. And, you know, this woman came in and she has just these large bald spots on her head from the hair loss because it is an autoimmune condition. And, you know, she had been gluten-free for about 2.5 years, was doing vitamin D, had gone through, you know, some leaky gut protocols, you know, tried a lot of things that are done in functional medicine. And so we just looked a little bit deeper, and the EBV was, in fact, active in her, and we didn't really do a lot. You know, she had already tried so much, so when patients come in like that, we don't want to redo things that they've done before. And so really we just focused on the Epstein-Barr virus, and within about 6 weeks, the hair started growing back, and she just started feeling much, much, much better. And I'm actually going to write this up with some photographs, you know, the before and after of the hair. You know, the bald spots and then it all filling in. And she's feeling great now. The hair is back. And like I said, we didn't really do a whole lot. You know, we just worked on the Epstein-Barr virus, and we just used the monolaurin and the reishi, and really that was it. So it's really fascinating when you can go in and you can just use two products, you know, two supplements, nothing else, and really turn someone around. So they're obviously not all like that, and they're not all that easy, but there's just a really, really interesting case and a direct connection there with the EBV.
Now, you mentioned, you know, some of the standard testing at Quest, you know, LabCorp or whatever. The EBV titer test that you can get through the commercial labs, are they of value? Are they usually high when there's a significant problem? Or in your...
Yeah, they, you know, with like LabCorp and Quest and labs like that, they have like an EBV profile, right, and they have a little chart, you know, with positives and minuses, and it says it's active or it's a past infection or it's reactivated. But I have a paper that was published, I believe it was last year, and I can send this to you. It's a complete review of how to interpret an Epstein-Barr virus profile. And so you look at the paper and you look at what the labs are offering, and they just don't click because they leave out the IgMs of the nuclear antigen and the early antigen. So you're not really getting the whole picture with their standard profile, so you have to add the IgMs in. And when you see the IgM, that's an excellent indication that there's reactivation. You're going to see high IgGs in everyone because everybody has it. So you're looking for the IgM for reactivation.
Yeah, if you can send me that paper, Nick, and I'll get it to our people to post to the call. So the download for the call, you'll be able to find the supporting documents, of course, and we'll put that one up there as well. Before we go to questions, tell us a little bit more about, I know you've been running some, postgraduate kind of educational courses through your infectionconnection.net for people who want to dive a little deeper into some of these specific concepts. So you want to just tell everyone about that?
Yeah, so this just basically stemmed out of just a lack of really good educational material out there on this topic. You know, studying functional medicine, going to seminars, things like that. You know, a lot of the training just sort of kind of glanced over it, mentioned it, you know, not a lot of detail. So I just put together this course online, and we just get heavily into, you know, Lyme disease and co-infections, viruses, parasites, just, you know, all the infections that are out there and their connection with autoimmune diseases and chronic illness. And then we get into, you know, how to manage these patients and how to identify if an infection is truly there. And we have a forum, and I'm going to be updating this, you know, on a regular basis as we learn more. And that's at infectionconnection.net. And, you know, the people who have signed up so far, they're really enjoying it at this point.
Can they find your thyroid book there as well, or is that a different place?
Yeah, the thyroid book is on Amazon.com, and then, you know, anyone who has signed up for the course, you know, I just send them a copy, complimentary.
Good. Okay. And it's the thyroid alternative, right? That's what they would search.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the thyroid alternative. It's on Kindle now too, I think. Yeah.
Let's go to questions if you have some time. Is that okay?
Great. Yeah. Yeah. Plenty of time.
I was just wondering if when you go through the whole procedure of reducing this Epstein-Barr, do you have to stay on a maintenance for the rest of their life? Or?
That's a really good question. You know, like I mentioned earlier, you know, we talked about the antivirals that we use and things like that. And, you know, I just preface that by saying that, you know, we're already doing everything else. Because a healthy, you know, robust immune system should be able to maintain the infection. So after you've done everything else, you know, optimized gut function, amino acids, vitamin D, you know, all those things that we do in functional medicine, as long as they can maintain health and, you know, keep their stress levels very low, no, they don't have to stay on something forever. There are some cases, though, where people just feel better, you know, taking something to suppress the infection and keep it at bay. But, you know, the answer to the question, that's just really going to be based on the individual. Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Okay.
have CIDP, chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy. Have you seen many patients with this disease, with the Epstein-Barr? And I was just wondering what the results were with your treatments in these cases. Thank you.
I've never seen a patient with that condition. I know that there is research out there on H. pylori and that particular condition, and I also believe herpes 6 and possibly some other viruses, but I can't remember directly off the top of my head. So, yeah, there is research out there on some connections there, but I don't have any personal experience with that condition.
Yeah, thank you.
I was wondering if you have been using any of the genetic panels now available to look at people's predisposition to being more susceptible to these reactivations of viral infections or being unable to deal with the infection?
No, I haven't done any of that testing. I don't have any experience with it.
Are you talking about genetic SNPs of some kind, or are you talking about predictive autoantibody?
More the genetic SNPs. There seems to be some that deal with people not being able to, like zinc wasters, people that just can't handle, that need a lot more zinc than typical, or there seems to be, as I'm learning, there's these just the genetic SNPs that seem to make people more, of course, with detoxification, but also in terms of susceptibility to immune issues.
Does the genetic testing change how you would treat the patient? I mean, if they have a genetic predisposition, is there anything that you can do about it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm still in the – I think the whole area is still very new, but it looks like if people have certain either heterozygous or homozygous issues – with these particular, because of these particular SNPs, that, for instance, if they have this problem with the zinc, that they're going to need a lot more zinc than a typical patient to keep their immune system in a better place. I'm still learning, but I was just curious if that was something you looked at all.
Yeah, sounds very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, there's this one test out now called 23andMe, which will look at, you know, basically all your raw data, but then knowing what's what is still hard to figure out unless you have somebody that's a little more knowledgeable, and so I'm still learning, but I was just curious if you had looked at that all yet.
Yeah, I'd like to learn more about it.
Yeah, okay, all right. I have more questions. I'll come back around.
Thanks.
All right,
Hi, I would like for you to hit that estrogen component again. I was wondering also about the estrogen, the EDD, and possibly herpes 2, if there's a connection between all of that.
Yeah, well, basically the connection with the estrogen is it's inversely proportional to the cytotoxic CD8 T cell levels. So the higher the estrogen levels in a woman or even a man for that matter, the lower the cytotoxic CD8 T cell levels. And then when estrogen levels drop, the CD8 levels rise. So that's the connection there. I haven't read anything on estrogen and herpes 2.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Hi. When we're targeting the EBV with the monolaurin and the antivirals, do we have to worry about die-off reactions? And if so, what would you use for that?
Right. That's one of the reasons why you do the pyramid scheme with the monolaurin. That's why we just start out, you know, with two or three capsules a day, and then you slowly build up. And that eliminates, you know, any kind of die-off reaction. And then, you know, with any of the other herbs that we talked about, kind of the same thing. You know, you can just start out slowly and work your way up.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I refer to it as a pyramid scheme with the patients, though. They might get a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Hi, Nicholas. This is Tom Lapine calling. Have you had any experience in reading the literature clinically with Epstein-Barr virus and DNA methylation? Because apparently, in my reading of the literature, the Epstein-Barr virus uses methylation of DNA to sort of hide itself from the immune system. And a lot of us are using, you know, folate activated folate supplements. Do you know of anything in the literature or clinically related to, you know, possibly looking at patients with Epstein-Barr virus and maybe MTHFR? Is there any connection there? And then one other side question is, have you found the monolaurin as effective as for some patients using antiviral Valtrex?
Okay, great. Yeah, so the you know, we do run the MTHFR, you know, blood test for the folate metabolism polymorphism, and you know, do use that sometimes, usually 5 to 10,000 micrograms a day, and then, you know, also looking at the mean corpuscular volume and the methylmalonic acid form aminoglutamate, you know, just seeing if there's any issues there. I'm just trying to think off the top of my head if I've seen any correlations there. And, you know, obviously not in everyone, but it is there sometimes. Now, my understanding of Valtrex, you know, I'm a non-prescribing physician, so I've never used it. But my understanding is that it also destroys the host cell, which may or may not be a bad thing, but I know that it works. I know that it's highly effective, you know, for herpes viruses, so it may be effective for EBV as well.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Hey, Todd, right. Are you still there?
Yes.
So with the stuff relating to methylation, they're saying that methylation is used by EBV to sort of stay stealth. Does that mean the better or the more efficient you are as a methylator, the more the EBV has a way to survive? Or would a polymorphism be a good thing or a bad thing? I'm kind of confused by that.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure either, but apparently my reading, and I can actually send this to you, David, you can actually put it on the web for the conference call, is that, you know, when DNA is methylated, it sort of goes silent. And apparently the Epstein-Barr virus can actually utilize methylation pathways such that it silences the body's own immune system so it can stay more stealth. That's my understanding.
Because, Todd, you know how I love to find issues like with polymorphisms or pathologies where they actually serve a purpose. I love that whole concept.
Exactly.
You know, survival of the sickest, why we need, you know, all this stuff we think of as being really bad and none of us should have it. A lot of the times there's a method to the madness, you know.
Exactly, yeah. So I'll forward that to both of you.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'd like to read about that.
Hi, thanks so much for the great talk. I just had a question about, to kind of clarify with your testing. Do you even bother with the EBV titer profile since it leaves out the IgM, or do you still do that? And then do you just do the CD4, CD8 ratio, or are there other things you do to kind of confirm the EBV?
I run all of the IgG and IgMs that are available. The CD4, CD8 ratio, I don't run those anymore just because when you kind of know what it's going to look like, there's no real reason to run it. The other one I forgot to mention is the CD57, which, you know, I've always used for Lyme disease, but I've started using it for just any kind of chronic infection. And if there's almost no chance that the patient has Lyme, I am seeing very low CD57 counts in a lot of these reactivated Epstein-Barr virus patients. So that's another thing that I'm looking at.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I have two quick questions. One, if one has a positive EBV antibody and is symptomatic, are you assuming there is an autoimmune condition present? And number two, is there any known relationship between diabetes type 1 and stealth infections?
Right. So if someone has an activated EBV infection, then that does not necessarily mean they have an autoimmune disease. So that
right.
could be active, and there's no autoimmunity. I'm sorry, what was the second part of that?
Is there any known relationship between diabetes type 1 and stealth infections?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's I have quite a few papers on that, type 1 diabetes, various viruses especially, food sensitivities, of course, mercury.
Bovine albumin. Bovine albumin peptide, very strong, but in genetic individuals.
No.
There's a lot of stuff on viruses, too. Yeah,
lots of on viruses. Cow's milk.
Right. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, my question is about thyroid receptor insensitivity. I'm an acupuncturist, and I see a lot of patients whose thyroid treatment just isn't working. They still have full-blown hypothyroid symptoms. Some of those are on standard thyroid replacement, and I try to direct them to better care. But some of them are on updated testing prescription, you know, custom compounded prescription, and still they've got the hypothyroid symptoms. Are these people, do these people have poor receptor sensitivity? And if so, what's it due to? You know, is it toxic, allergic, infectious causes, and what can be done about it?
Right. So, you know, thyroid disrupting chemicals, you know, can affect the thyroid receptor. It's really difficult to pinpoint, you know, if there is chemical toxicity to the thyroid receptor. But the other thing that I've been looking at a lot is the total T3 to the reverse T3 ratio. And I'm seeing a lot of this where, you know, obviously the reverse T3 is high, and that can make the numbers look fine. But the patient still has, you know, severe signs of hypothyroidism. And so we divide the total T3 divided by the reverse T3 and looking for a number between 10 to 14. And a lot of times it's going to come in lower than that. And so that can be an indicator that they just need more T3. And by pushing the T3, you're obviously making more available to the thyroid receptors, and then you will also push down the reverse T3 by doing that. So that's just kind of an approach that I've been using that's been working pretty well.
You said total T3 to reverse T3 ratio, not free T3 to reverse T3.
Right, yeah, not just the total, the total T3.
Okay.
And dividing that by the reverse T3.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Yes, I wanted to ask what lab you use for your all the IgMs and IgG Epstein Barr that you do get.
I use medical diagnostic laboratories. They'll do the IgG and IgMs for the nuclear antigen, viral capsid antigen, and the early antigen.
Okay. All right. And can you just review this total T3 to reverse T3 ratio? You said you want it to be about 10 to 14?
Exactly, yeah.
So if it's, in other words, if it's more than that, it's a problem, or if it's less than that,
If it's less than that. So what you're going to see is a lot of them are going to come in between, you know, 4 and 8.
Okay.
And so we would consider that low, and it's just going to function much, much better if it's between 10 and 14.
Okay, or the total is, okay, I got it. Just kind of excited. Okay. All right, very good. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, well, great. Thank you, Nick. Wonderful clinical rounds call again. We really appreciate you taking your time this evening to be with us, and I'm sure you'll be with us again soon. And wanted to remind everybody, if you're at IHS in New York coming up here in the first very end of February, first weekend in March, come say hi. I'll be speaking on Saturday the 2nd in the morning on this very topic in autoimmunity. We have Core 3 on autoimmune conditions and self-infections in South Florida in the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood area on March 23rd, and then in Philadelphia in June. Andy, do you have that June date? I don't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, it's actually June 15th.
June 15th. And then we have our thyroid, adrenal thyroid, diabetes, Core 2 seminar with Dr. Alan Weiss and Becky Murray. And what was the date of that, Andy?
That is going to be April 6th in Nashville.
April 6th in Nashville, great. And then Glacier Fest, of course. Come join us at Glacier Fest and first weekend in August. And we really appreciate everyone being on Clinical Rounds, and we'll have another great call for you next Wednesday night. So thank you, everybody, and good night.